I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. I'm your host, Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore, as you know, it's another episode. And today's episode's a cracker. It's Danny Wallace. Was super hyped to do this episode because Danny was someone that I'd had in mind right from the very beginning of this podcast, that as someone that I really wanted to chat to after hearing him on Scroop's Distraction Pieces, I was like, got to get Danny on. And in a weird kind of way, all of that helped to actually get this date in the diary, which we touch upon at the beginning of this podcast anyway. We discuss Danny's life, obviously, and the songs that have soundtracked his creative journey, and he goes in on many places that he's lived and many different sort of jobs he's done within his career as a writer, broadcaster, DJ, you name it. We do discuss the lot on this episode. So before we get on with it, big thanks first of all to Danny for coming and doing this. Thanks for Scroob for helping facilitate this, and I should say thanks to everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. Actually, there's a huge bundle of amazing podcasts over there, and I'm very proud to be involved in that gang of people. Thanks to 76 for producing this. Thanks to My Name Is Ad for the cover artwork on this. And if you like this episode, then please subscribe and go and have a look in the back catalogue, because there's loads of other episodes with actors, bands, DJs, producers, comedians. There's bundles there to get stuck into. So please go and have a rummage around there. And if that's not enough for you and you want some more, then I do have a Patreon page where I also put an exclusive episode on there each week. And there's also T-shirts and art prints and all sorts of stuff available. So if you want to find out about every single thing I've just been banging on about, www.offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. It's all there. One-stop shop. Let's get back to the job at hand. Please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with the wonderful Danny Wallace. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing. www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year. And they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music. And they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands, alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out, because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk, official sponsors of Off The Beaten Track podcast. Let's get back to that podcast. It's Off The Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin. Right, we are recording. We are in a nice hotel in Soho. And I'm joined today by Danny Wallace.
Hello, Stu. Thanks for having me. It is a nice hotel, but we are sort of in a very weird, tiny outdoor terraced bit.
Yeah.
Surrounded by pot plants. And I bet you we're going to hear builders.
Yeah, but I mean, we hummed and hawed about whether or not to record out here because there might be a little bit of, sort of background noise. But I put the... Do I call them cans in the world of podcasting and music?
Yes, I suppose you can, yeah.
So I put the cans on and there was no background noise. So if you guys pick up on anything, then it's not to worry about because when we looked in the hotel room, there was no table for the mic stands.
No. If there is any building noise and it bothers people, they can always write to their MP.
Exactly. Or March. That's what people do these days.
That's what everyone's doing.
All right, well, look, thanks ever so much for doing this, Danny. It was, it kind of come about in a weird way, right?
Yeah.
So, I heard you on my pal Pip's podcast.
That's right, yeah.
And then Pip and I also have a magazine called The Pod Bible.
That's right.
And when I got asked what was my favourite podcast episode, pained me, obviously, to big up one of my mates. No one wants to do that, do they? And but it was... the episode with yourself on Scroobs. And
which was so nice of you.
Thank you.
It was really, really, really nice and a wonderful surprise. And I enjoyed talking with Pip.
Yeah.
I don't know him well enough to call him Pip yet. Do you know what I mean?
When people... Well, what was you calling him? You weren't calling him Scroobius.
I suppose I'd have to call him Scroobius Pip. We haven't reached that level yet where I'm allowed to call him Pip.
And it was an episode that... Every now and again, like, I'll see something or I'll hear something that it sounds like I'm blowing smoke up your ass here now, but like, inspired me and, like, fired me up.
Wow.
Because your upbringing was amazing well, hopefully we'll talk about some of that today
as
well.
Yeah, of course, yeah,
whatever
you want.
But, yeah, if you do enjoy this thing, go and check out Danny on Pips as well. So, okay, so we always start a podcast with track one, which is a song with the greatest intro.
Yes. I'm aware of that, and I'm aware that there have been some brilliant songs chosen with incredible intros. But for me, an intro, it's like what I'm about to say won't, you know, for a lot of people, be the greatest intro of all time. But for me, it sort of is, because when you hear a song on the radio or it comes at you at a surprise and you hear that familiarity, all these memories come rushing back and all this excitement, and it places you at a certain time. So for me, it was a toss-up between either the beginning of Ray Parker Jr.'s Ghostbusters, obviously the Citizen Kane of comedy, or what I've gone for, Power of Love by Huey Lewis and the News, because that immediately places me back in the early 80s when Back to the Future came out, which had this incredible impact on me and probably on my work, since it was this high concept. And we all know Back to the Future, but for a kid watching it, this high concept, what if scenario with a kid as cool as Marty McFly, who I immediately started like buying Look-In and Fast Forward, anything that might have a Marty McFly poster in it.
Yeah.
Any of those magazines, I would have it. I started wearing a body warmer.
Yeah.
And a checked shirt. And I remember the greatest compliment a kid at school ever paid me was that my body warmer made me look a bit like Marty McFly.
I'd take that, mate.
Yeah. So it was just this iconic moment. And all those films that came out in that exact period, I think, married a high concept with great comedy and also great soundtracks.
Yeah.
That really impacted on me and sort of informed what I wanted to do.
Do you think that still exists? That connection of big soundtracks with big movies, like, because I think throughout the 90s, obviously, with Pulp Fiction, Trainspotting, things like that, it was huge. But do you think that still exists to the level it did then? Because just thinking of Power of Love and Back to the Future, straight away I think Stand By Me,
yeah.
And I think Mannequin with the Starship record.
Yeah,
But so many come hand in hand with huge tunes, and Top Gun and things like that.
Yeah, and they would actually have they would then go on Top of the Pops or record a special music video with the cast, and it just became this like package. And I think it's probably every generation tries to bring stuff back from their childhood. So nowadays we're getting things like Guardians of the Galaxy, and James Gunn, and people who remember that and sort of refer to those kind of mixtapes that we all would have, and you'd wait, and you know that thing of, trying to record it off the radio and trying to cut off the DJ before he started speaking. I think that, so now I think it's coming back for my generation, as the next generation will have theirs.
Okay. And
but there's nothing cooler than when that comes on. You want to grab a skateboard, run down the high street, and hang on to the back of a bin lorry. That's how it makes me feel. Did I ever go at what?
Hold on to the back of a car on a skateboard?
Yeah, I did. Very, very slow, because I convinced my mum to buy me a skateboard.
Right.
And I'd seen all kids on skateboards all around. I was in Loughborough at that point, and there was kids on skateboards, and they were amazing. They could just push off, and this got all the way down the street. But my mum bought me one from, Intersport that was about $9.99.
And a lovely nod to Intersport there.
Home with a bum bag. And it didn't go very fast at all. It was a lot of effort. It was extraordinarily tiring.
Yeah.
It was like a full body workout just to go 30 feet. So I did try once clinging onto the back of mum's Nissan Micra. In fact, just before it was stolen, not during. That would have been exciting. But that Nissan Micra was later found at the bottom of a reservoir somewhere in Leicestershire. And in it were two of my favourite things. There was Now That's What I Call Music 11, I think, or something, and the soundtrack for Back to the Future.
What else was on that soundtrack?
On Now That's What I Call... Oh, on Back to the Future?
Yeah. I'm just trying to think what other songs were on it.
Well, there was Johnny Be Good.
Of course.
Which I would listen to on my Walkman until the battery was properly running down, at which point it became a very slow ballad.
Yeah.
But quite sort of... but still quite pleasing to listen to, because you could learn the lyrics better that way. That was the benefit of, nowadays things just stop.
Yeah.
Your iPod just stops, your phone just stops. But back then, you could get another hour out of it, And if you held down fast forward slightly, you could sort of get the pace
back. That's a great shout.
So Johnny Be Good was the big one for me after Power of Love. Stuck in Time, I just remembered that as well. That was a Huey Lewis written specifically for the soundtrack.
Did you see the recent video of the Coldplay show where Michael J. Fox come out and they played Johnny Be Good?
I did not, but I'm doing that as soon as we've finished.
Worth a look, mate.
Yeah.
Worth a look.
No, absolutely.
Huey Lewis as well. He was a pop star then. I mean, I've looked at, done a bit of research and down. We're of the same age.
Yeah.
And Huey Lewis, how old do you reckon he was?
He had a gravelly voice.
But he looked like one of your dad's mates, even though I bet he was about 25.
Completely. Because then I would go and I'd go down to the corner shop and try and find, any albums. All they ever had was a Michael Jackson cassette, and no one ever bought it. And I had to save up to buy that eventually. But I managed to get some of the Huey Lewis stuff. And my God, there's one, I think it's called Sports Bar or something. And it's a picture of Huey Lewis and his friends, the News.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. It looks like a meeting at a golf club.
Yeah.
It looks it's one of those nights where your dad has invited his friends around and suddenly he becomes a normal person, not your dad.
That was pop stars in the 80s though, wasn't it?
I think it was to a certain extent. And I mean, you could never really say that Huey Lewis and the News were cool, I think. I mean, maybe they were at one point.
Well, they were hip to be square, though, weren't they?
Hip to be square, which I won that as a vinyl single at Loughborough Town Fair. I was able to choose two singles, and there was Hip to Be Square, and there was something by a band called Flasher, which I've never heard of, and I don't think I've ever listened to, because I was a bit embarrassed as a kid, because I knew what that meant.
Yeah.
And the front cover is just a man flashing. But I found them the other day.
Oh, really?
Yes, so I've still got it, so maybe I'll whip that out to quote Flasher.
What is Flasher? Was it rock? Was it?
I don't know. I've never listened to it. but it was well put together. It was red vinyl.
Okay, right. track two, Danny. The first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you.
This is a weird one.
Weird why?
Weird because it did have an emotional impact on me, a proper one, but it had an emotional impact on a young boy, me, who really had nothing to relate it to, apart from the sort of the pure emotion of it and the quiver in Dolly Parton's voice when she's singing Jolene, right? And I hadn't even had, you know, a whisper of a rumour of a hint of a girlfriend. Yeah. But I could hear in this woman's voice the pain and the sparse lyrics, the kind of the pure storytelling, how she was able to convey this entire life and, you know, this position that she was in, a real position of weakness and desperation, in just a few words. And she's just going, look, Jolene, you know, fellas like you, you've got no problems. I've got my guy. It's all I've got. Please don't take him away. And for some reason, that really had an impact on me. Just hearing someone almost begging in song. And nowadays, I think that would be very, very, a very different song because it would be instead going, all right, mate, you know, if Jolene's so good, why don't you go off with Jolene?
Yeah.
Leave me, you know. So it's and yet that story and that sadness is a proper human emotion and something that people go through constantly, no matter the social climate. And there's another song. There's a song called "I'll Kill Her" by someone called Soko, which is a sort of quite a similar situation, but coming at it from a completely different angle and one of anger as well. Just kind of going, we were supposed to have a brilliant life together, and now this woman has nicked that future away from me. We were supposed to have a little boy and a little girl called Susan, born in Japan, and now that's all been robbed from me, and I'll kill her. And I like, for the same reasons, the sort of the sort of the heart bursting kind of honest angle. So so Jolene is a strange choice for me, but I do remember almost my eyes welling up listening to it.
If I was ever to do this list myself, Jolene will be mine.
Really?
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
So what's the story there?
The story would be purely spending a lot of time around my grandparents as a kid, and they had a bundle of albums that I wasn't particularly interested in or knew anything about.
Yeah.
But I remember thinking Dolly Parton, the best of Dolly Parton, she looked really pretty.
Yeah.
and so I just remember putting that album on, and there's I'm no Dolly Parton expert, but there was a song on there called Many Colours, and there was another song on there called Applejack, and I've never heard them songs since
I've never heard of Applejack,
Yeah, and Jolene, and it is the fact that her voice cracks, and it is that desperation.
Yeah.
And I guess it's, a lot of songs aren't quite as storytelling as that song. It's quite easy to understand, isn't it? And it's
simple
kind of
story,
spoon-fed
well
to you. And yeah, absolutely. And I think, that would definitely have been mine as well.
Wow, that's good to know. Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it, when you were a kid, and we didn't really have many albums in the house. Well, we did, but it was all like opera. and then we just had, there was one Beatles album, which was just ballads, and there was a Johnny Cash album. And so those tended to be the ones that I would listen to until I could go down the library and rent Queen or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, so they has a real impact.
So how old was you when Jolene?
Poor Jolene, I was probably only about 9.
Okay.
You know, so when I say, you know, earlier when I said there wasn't even the hint of a rumour of a girlfriend, I didn't really know what girls were.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I knew what a family unit was, and I knew what love was.
Yeah.
And the sort of the purity of her voice.
Yeah.
And just the sort of the rising, the way that the song builds, and it's got that kind of quick pace to it. It's sort of a sense of urgency.
Yeah, there is a sense of urgency about that. So that's an important thing to throw in there, because it almost feels like the music is powering along, but it feels like her voice is kind of half-time to the music. It's quite a weird sort of...
It's like the situation's unstoppable and she's trying to stop it.
Yeah, that's... Know? Nailed it there, mate. So where was you at this point? Where was home?
That would have been in Loughborough. So we'd left Dundee, where I'd grown up, and which I still really felt was my home. I still do. I feel British first, but then I feel Scottish. And we moved to Leicestershire, where no one could really understand my accent, because I had a very, very strong Dundonian accent at the time.
And how old was you when you moved?
I was about 8.
Right. So you know, just sort of going back to listening to you on Pips, you move quite a lot throughout your life, haven't you?
Mm.
And like, how do you find that? And now, have you got your own children now?
Yeah, I do.
Like,
yeah.
How would you feel about moving them? And like, because for me, the thought of being moved schools when I was a child would have been like horrific. The thought of it, like, yeah. I couldn't have imagined it.
Yeah.
And like, how was that?
It was good. I don't remember my heart sinking. It must have sunk at some point when you're essentially told, we're going to move away to a random place you'd never heard of.
Yeah.
And there's no email at that point. There's no, you know, phones. You can't keep in touch with your friends as in the way that you might want to. But we did it. And we moved to Berlin for a year. And my dad just bought a camper van. I'll never understand why we didn't fly. But we, you know, he bought a camper van, an old VW banger, and we drove from Loughborough to Berlin. And it was a great year. It was a brilliant time to be there. The wall had just come down, very exciting. I went to an American school, which is, you know, again, made me feel a bit like Marty McFly.
Yeah.
That's all. I just wanted to meet Americans at that point.
Yeah.
Things have changed since then. But at that point, you know, that was the most exciting thing in the world. And I met people that I would never normally have met, and suddenly developed friends who were all over the world. And I wanted some of that for my kids. And so when we decided we were going to get out of London, I was like, why don't we do something with the kids? Why don't we take them? Why don't we show them? Why don't we let them do that? And so we moved to LA. And we just moved to LA for a year. The idea was we'd go there, drink in the sunshine, again, let the kids meet people that they would never normally have met and do things they would never normally have done. And it was a wonderful year to do that. And it had a huge effect on my son in the way that it had an effect on me. It taught him how to speak to almost anybody. Because I'm an only child. And so I had to make friends very, very quickly.
Were you confident?
I guess I found it, because you have to.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you end up in a Spanish hotel for a week with your parents and no one to talk to.
Yeah.
And so you immediately run off to the games room and see someone who's roughly your age and start chatting.
Yeah.
And my son does that. And he and my daughter, and they can make friends in moments now.
Wow. That's a great skill to have.
It's good to be able to walk into a room and just go, "Hello. This is me. Who are you?"
Yeah.
And not worry about it.
Yeah.
And part of it is lying.
Yeah.
Part of it is pretending you have that. But no, it's good. And he went to this cool school. It's called Wonderland. And
is this in LA?
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah, exactly. And we, you know, apart from, you know, the threat of earthquakes and the shooter drills, the school was wonderful. But it was, there were kids there, you know, who didn't have, you know, 2 cents to rub together. And at the same time, there was like Pharrell's son.
Right.
So you had a proper mix of the world, which is why I always like state schools.
Yeah.
Because you meet everybody.
Yeah.
And that is the way to be.
Yeah. That's healthy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Track 3, Danny. The song that reminds you of your school days.
Well, on that note, when we'd moved from Dundee, as I say, I had this very strong Scottish accent. So strong as to be almost impenetrable to some of the people in Leicestershire who were just like, "What are you?" And my accent started to fade quite quickly. And my mum is Swiss, so she's got a Swiss accent. My dad's from the north of England. So there was no one to back up my accent. There was no brothers, no sisters. There was no one else Scottish. Which is why I fell in love with the Proclaimers. Because they were singing in their accent. It wasn't the sort of thing that was happening in the 80s of everyone suddenly, from the DJ on the radio to the bands they were playing, adopting this sort of transatlantic drawl and pretending to be something they weren't. These were two, you know, unusual-looking fellas with stories to tell, but they weren't afraid to tell those stories in their natural accent.
Yeah.
And it was weird and unfashionable, and it really stood out. And so it became like a way of remembering Dundee.
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, Letter from America and later 500 Miles. But I always remember like Sunshine on Leith coming out and it being so sort of beautiful. And so unashamedly Scottish.
Yeah.
They weren't trying not to be.
Yeah.
That it had a real impact on me into my teens, you know.
It's a absolutely beautiful record, that.
It is.
Did you see the...
You're going to say the football match.
Oh, my God.
I did, and I showed it to my son, and I showed it to my daughter.
I had Colin Murray do this, and he chose football songs like that crowd sing, and he sent me this, and he went, have you ever seen Sunshine on a Leaf with Hibs fans? I was like, no.
Yeah.
And I watched it, and it was pure goosebumps. I was like, it's so, wow.
It is. It's goosebumps. It's unity.
Yeah.
It's enjoyment. It's heart-filling.
Yeah.
And it's everybody.
Yeah.
You know, you can imagine zooming in and seeing the police horses joining in.
Yeah.
So for me, you know, that song in particular, and I would always remember because my mum would be in the kitchen, she'd be making, you know, she'd be chopping a carrot or something, and then we'd put on that album, you know, again and again. There's one song called Jean, which you always like, because there's the lady next door to us in Dundee was called Jean, and there's a moment, because I was always playing tricks on my mum, there's a moment in the song that it just descends into this sort of raucous chaos where the Charlie and Craig Reed are just singing, love her, I love her, I love her, and it just goes on for about a minute, and I convinced my mum that they were singing about Loughborough, and just going, Loughborough, 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 which I think she may still believe on some level.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I was terrible like that with mum. I remember convincing her that a cat could talk.
How do you convince someone that a cat can talk?
Well, she can't hear very well in one ear, so she finds it hard to place where sound has come from. And she loves cats so much, and she's such a golden-hearted woman, that she would wish for nothing more in this world than for a cat to be able to speak.
Right.
I think that would make everything brilliant. And we just walked in one day, and she went, hello, Sammy, to our cat. And then I just went, hello, Mrs. Wallace. And she span around and looked me in the eye and went, did you hear that?
Did you roll with it?
I rolled with it for a bit.
Yeah.
And then I had to sort of bring her back down to earth.
Yeah.
Because you know,
so it could get weird, couldn't it?
It could get weird. You know, he turns up. I'd have to take it further and get him a top hat.
Hello. I've interrupted the podcast again, haven't I? Sorry. It won't take a sec. All I want to say is, the songs that we're talking about in this podcast, if we can't play them, it's just because of the regulations regarding playing licensed music and such. So if you want to hear the songs, just go over to Spotify and...
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Search Off the Beat and Track podcast, and you can listen to all the songs because I've put playlists up for each of these. If you can't find it on there, I'll send links on all the social media accompanying each episode. So you've just got to press that one button and you can go through and you can enjoy all the songs that our guest picks. Anyway, I'll shut up, get back to the podcast. See you on the other side. Did you watch the recent documentary about the Proclaimers on BBC Three?
No.
Oh, Danny, you need to watch it.
On BBC Three? No, I had no idea.
BBC Three or BBC One. What's the one that does all the music documentaries? BBC Four, I
Four.
Think. Oh, it's cracking, mate.
Is it?
Yeah, absolutely cracking. And they really hone in on the fact that they sung in their accents at a time when Deacon Blue, Wet, Wet, Wet.
Yeah.
And all of these Scottish bands that were blowing up, weren't singing in their accents.
They weren't, no.
And they couldn't sound more Scottish, really, could they?
No. I want them to sound as Scottish as possible.
Yeah.
And when you see them, you know, you just look up on YouTube, you just see them with a crowd, and it's just this raw... They don't look like the type of men that you would imagine would have this kind of raw power and raw emotion, and yet, almost more than anyone, you know, they really do. They care, and they're political. They can be a bit raunchy at times, which I find uncomfortable.
Right, tell me about when the Proclaimers have ever been raunchy, I've never seen it.
Lyrically, they say a few things, you know, about, you know, for your stolen body, my heart's going to pound. And, you know, I don't know about the word stolen in that context. I'm not quite, or stretching inside, you know. There's various things they say.
Not need to be thinking of them brothers doing stuff like that.
No.
Okay, so you've moved down from Dundee. Did you enjoy school?
Yeah, school was fine. It was fine. I mean, I always liked doing the project stuff.
Yeah.
I think I talked to Pip about that as well. I was never into the, I don't want to say the learning, but, you know, I liked it when I was given a thing that was mine to do, and then I would just go off and do it.
Right.
And I think that's something I carried with me.
So you were creative from a very young age?
Well, it was more that, okay, so this is now my responsibility to do this thing, create this thing. And it could have been about the most tedious thing in the world, but I would put my all into it. And so I suppose that kind of informed what I did later on. But equally, I would say, as much as that, things like, you know, we talked about Back to the Future and that idea of a big concept, that kind of thing always stuck with me. When I first saw Ghostbusters, when I first saw Back to the Future, when I saw any of those films, that idea that here's a big what if, now let's have fun with it. Let's see where it takes us. So you have that initial idea that hooks, and then the fun is in how it plays out. And that, I suppose, has also been, you know, quite instructive to what I've done over the years.
I was about to say that, yeah, very much so.
So it's that thing of, what if I do this?
Yeah.
Where is the fun?
Yeah.
Let's go find it.
Yeah. And so, that's reflective in your writing, obviously, as well. And
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so, absolutely. It's that thing of, it's a mixture of school projects and Back to the Future.
Yeah. okay, so when you moved to Berlin, how old was you then?
I would have been 12, 13.
Right, so when you come back, secondary school was where?
We moved to Bath.
Okay.
Which only happened, I think that only happened when we were in Berlin, that happened. So then it was like, all right, I'm not going back to my old mates, I suppose. We're going somewhere else. And so we moved to Bath, and I didn't know anything about it. I just knew that we kept moving south, and so our houses kept getting smaller.
Yeah.
And then we're in this little place in Bath. And I remember going out the first night with Mum and Dad to explore, and we got as far as McDonald's, and we just bought a McDonald's. And as we walked home, someone in a bush threw an egg at my dad. it didn't smash, it just bounced off him. But it was weird.
Yeah.
It was still like, where have we moved?
Yeah.
What is this?
Yeah.
And it was harder to make...
And that's horrible, right?
It was weird.
Yeah.
It was just some kids up in it. I mean, you know, and I'm as guilty. I've never thrown an egg at a man. But, you know... I did things like that when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
I remember, because I say I used to play tricks on my mum. She would walk around Bath sometimes with a sign on her back that just said, I'm a wise old woman. And then she'd get home and she'd be like, everyone was really friendly to me in town. But I'd take it too far sometimes, because it would be that thing of like liking a little project. I remember there was a man down our street who I assume is long since passed now, Mr. Montgomery. And I doubt he'd mind me saying this anyway, because it's all true. But, you know, he used to hate the fact that we used to play football on the street. He used to put notes on my dad's car if my dad parks a metre away from where he should have.
Yeah.
And he used to... he had all these pot plants in his porch, loads and loads of pot plants. And so one day, I thought, I'm going to teach him a lesson. And I had a really basic computer, and I made a letter. And the letterhead was, hay fever sufferers unite. And I wrote this letter to Mr. And I'm not, I don't have a hay fever, but I wrote a letter to Mr. Montgomery just saying, "Dear Mr. Montgomery, we recently had an agent patrolling the streets in your area and found that the number of pot plants in your porch exceeds our national guidelines.
Of course.
Please limit the number of pot plants to either 6 large or 8 small. Or further action will be taken," right? Just did that, whatever, it was a bit of fun. But I thought, take the joke further. So I said it was from Dr. Simon Davies, right? And Simon was a kid at school. And I put his number, thinking Mr. Montgomery will phone Simon and go, "What is this?" And it'll be funny, just an extra little joke.
Yeah.
Anyway, I woke up about 2 days later, and it was Simon's mum.
Okay.
And she went, "I think Simon's been kidnapped." Yeah. And I was like, "I'm sure he hasn't. What do you mean?" And she went, "We had this phone call from a man asking for Dr. Simon Davies and blah, blah, blah." And she got into her head that therefore Simon had been kidnapped, which is a leap to make. Anyway, I reassured her. I didn't admit it at that point.
Yeah, of course.
But then she phones back and goes, "Do you have access to printing equipment?" And I said, "Yes, we've got a printer." And I admitted it. And then I had to wait for my mum to get home. And I thought, this is the worst thing anyone's ever done. This is like a war crime. And my stomach was churning. My eyes were wet.
Secretly quite pleased, though?
No, I was terrified.
Really?
Yeah. And I told my mum, and then I looked up, and she was weeping with laughter. So that was the kind of house I grew up in.
That's a great mum.
Great mum. Great dad. They both just went, brilliant. That's great. It's imaginative.
Well, generally when I do these, I like to ask, was your creativity and because... Am I right in saying when you was at school, you was writing for computer game magazines?
Yeah.
Okay. So was that in Bath?
That was in Bath, yeah. It happened because I got a headache. I got a headache one day. I didn't get much pocket money and I wasn't really old enough to get a job, I thought. I later worked at Argos. But I managed to get a computer magazine. I was starting to get into Sega, I think because I hadn't made proper friends yet.
Yeah.
So I started reading about video games in the hope that I could buy a Mega Drive one day or whatever. And I saw these pictures of this team of people who were like all having fun. And I recognised a building that they were standing near. And then I realised that this magazine was in Bath.
Okay.
So when work experience kind of came around, or an early sort of type of work experience, I was given the option of doing some very, very dull things. And so I was like, can I try and get something? And they were like, sure. So I managed to get my way into this magazine.
What was it called?
It was called Sega Power. And this was just a bunch of... for me, they were like grown-ups, right? I would assume they were sort of our age, if I'd been that age again. But no, they were all about 23.
Yeah.
And had just been given big budgets at a time when these magazines were selling loads. And could just have fun. And it was like going into a sort of university campus where everyone was cool, in my eyes. and they were getting paid to play games. And so I managed to write a review for them. Someone got sick for a week or so, and they offered me a job. So I did more and more and more, and I stuck with them. And then they all left that magazine and went to different magazines. So suddenly I was writing proper for loads of magazines, including about things I had no idea. I ended up working for Nintendo magazine as well. They had a tips guy called Alan, who got the job because he was like the Nintendo champion, and then he didn't do it anymore. So I took it over and called it Don't Ask Alan. But I was answering people's questions about Nintendo games that I'd never played.
And how old was you then?
I think that was probably from about 14.
So you're getting paid to do this as well then?
Yeah, it was extraordinary. I remember standing outside Dixon's and I'd just been given a cheque for 100 quid, for which was an unthinkable amount of money.
Yeah.
And I was just looking, going, I could buy anything.
Yeah.
And I bought a Discman.
Wow.
So, I'd upgraded from the Walkman
that
I used to listen to Johnny B. Good on.
Yeah.
And then that got me into sort of more music because it was exciting when, I could get my own CDs and take control of my own thing. And I was doing that, writing for those magazines, but I think I still had a paper round. I was mixing it up.
And so you're writing...
Shows how keen I was to get into the media if I'm also doing a paper round.
Absolutely.
Distribution. Media distribution professional.
But was your writing encouraged at school as well?
Well, yeah.
Did they pick up on the fact that you had a flair for it?
I suppose. Yeah, I suppose. Because my English teachers would tolerate a bit of fun from me as well.
Were they aware that you was a published magazine writer.
I think so, but I think it was still very... Even though these magazines were selling in the hundreds of thousands, I mean, if you don't know about Sega, it's an invisible world.
Of course, yeah.
It's just hidden. But they would encourage me. They'd encourage a bit of fun. I'd do stuff like... I remember finishing an English exam early. And I had about 5 minutes to spare.
Yeah.
So I just got another piece of paper and I wrote the worst possible essay I could as quickly as I could and then just handed it in under someone else's name. Knowing that they would know it was me, yeah. You know, eventually. And I remember, you know, in our design and communication lessons or whatever, my mate, Little Dan, he was called Little Dan because he was about an inch shorter than me, he'd spent ages designing a shopping centre called the Paragon, and it had taken him like months and months. And then
great name for a shopping centre.
Good name. And then I, when teacher was taking register, I just gave her an envelope, and it had Little Dan's name on it. And she looked at me as if to go, "What are you doing?" And I looked at her as if to go, "Just trust me." And she nodded, and then she gave it to Little Dan and went, "There's a letter here for you." And in it was, again, I'd written another letter with a fake letterhead from Paragon Shopping Centres International, who, as part of their school outreach program, had stumbled across his work. And we're now about to launch a major court case against him.
Yeah.
And then it was all about just that moment of just looking over and seeing, but then not letting him believe it for too long.
Yeah.
But the teachers were sort of in on it. So I had fun with them.
Yeah.
Maths, no. History, no. Geography, apart from doing a project, no. Science, no.
Yeah.
But mucking about and being a bit creative, but doing it in a way that hopefully felt... I mean, those are stupid examples, but they were a whole in some way. Yeah. It was a moment. It had a beginning, a middle, and an end,
yeah.
And it got the result I wanted.
Yeah.
And it was just and it bonded us a bit.
Yeah,
and
there was no skills, aren't they?
Yeah, and there was no malice. It was like a sort of hey, and I welcome it when people do it to me.
Yeah,
I love it. In fact,
okay. So we'll go back a little bit now. I imagine looking at the sort of the song choices that have already been discussed. Track 4, Danny, is the first record you remember buying.
Ah, yeah. So I bought it at Woolworths. I went with my dad to the Midland Bank, where I had a Griffin Savers account.
Did you get the bag? The Midland Bank bag?
I got the pencil case.
The blue pencil case. Yeah. Yep.
With the Griffin on it. And I got the ID card, which made me feel like a...
Meant nothing.
Meant nothing.
Yeah.
But made me feel like a man.
Yep.
I withdrew, I think it was £1.75, something like that. It, you know, so I still had about 50p to my name. And I went in and I bought Lionel Richie, Dancing on the Ceiling.
Yeah.
Because I'd seen it on Top of the Pops. And if you haven't seen a video, you won't believe it. They all dance on the ceiling.
Yeah.
And it's extraordinary.
It's equal parts shit and brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's shilliant. Or Brit. You know. But it's it was great. It was this marriage of a strange idea, but with a song that you could really kind of get into.
Yeah.
And the song just reminded you of the video.
Yeah.
And it made me happy. And so I've still got it. And so I went, I went and I got that. I would always have to go on a Saturday if I had any money to withdraw some and buy. I bought Way of the Exploding Fist, was the first video game I ever bought.
Oh, that's a good start.
Great. And that was from the same, on the BBCB, and that was from the same Woolworths. So it's amazing when you look back at shops like that, that are now gone, and you just remember those kind of high street, Loughborough High Street, you know, the Wimpy, the Woolworths, and that's all you needed, really.
Woolworths, I mean, you've mentioned like going in there and buying your computer games and buying your records. But you would walk past an island of Pick-a-Mix like nowhere else in the world, wouldn't you?
No, it was it was a field of dreams.
It really was.
A real field of dreams.
Never bought any, though. It struck me they'd be really expensive as a kid.
Well, I just remember Ian Fletcher doing the thing that we all did. We all had a mate who would go there, take a sweet off the Pick-a-Mix, put it on the scale, it wouldn't register, and he'd go, "Well, I guess it's free." And then he'd wolf it down, and you'd walk out, but with a real spring in your step in case you were tackled by security.
Yeah.
Never happened.
I've never done that, but like that's the sort of thing that like the tough kids in school would do that.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so... You kind of, you've started sort of listening to things like the Proclaimers and things like that. So was there a real kind of, passion to sort of pursue music a little bit more as you sort of getting a little bit older? Had you found what you wanted to sort of, what genres appealed to you and whatnot? Moving up, I'm moving forwards to get to the next question, which is your time in Clubland. But before we get there, just wondering about them sort of years between sort of finishing school and getting to the age where you can go clubbing and
stuff.
Well,
there's a great age where all music is new music.
Yeah.
And you don't know really what you're into yet, but your friends are starting to peel off.
Yeah.
And one friend is into hip hop, and another friend is, you know, is just into straight out Capital FM pop or whatever.
Yeah.
And I never found after that, I suppose I went through a brief Stock Aitken Waterman period.
Yeah.
You know, because that was, those were the cultural icons at the time.
Yeah.
Your Kylies and your Jason Donovans and stuff like that. And it's just blasted at you. You can't go to the roller disco without it being pure Stock Aitken Waterman the whole time.
Yeah.
And then you sort of, your tastes mature and people start passing you tapes. For me, actually, the tapes that I would get would be comedy, things like that. And so I would kind of, and I think that weirdly I started to get into musical comedy or rather things like Tom Lehrer, who was this 1950s and 60s satirist who was singing about things that I had no idea what he was talking about. He was talking about, you know, the vice president in 1965. But he would create these wonderful songs. And musical comedy has always had detractors and people who think it's easy or whatever. And it isn't, I think. I could never do it. But to create a well-crafted song that's not only lovely to listen to and catchy, but says something and is funny with it. You know, I had a period where I was just listening to things like Tom Lehrer. And then, you know, the age hits where you find out what you think is cool or what speaks to you. And for me, it was there were two great wars going on in the 90s after the Gulf War, of course. There was Sega versus Nintendo, and there was Oasis versus Blur.
Yeah.
So I was, you know, I survived the deadly indie wars of the mid-90s.
Yeah.
And it was difficult to sort of come up with one because there were so many. I remember my first real gig that I went to. Well, then my first comedy gig was John Shuttleworth. So again, that's music and comedy. And, you know, maybe I should have chosen something like that. But after that, it was Oasis in a little cricket club, the Bath Pavilion cricket ground or whatever, right before they did Glastonbury, I think. So those big songs, and there seemed to be thousands of bands. There just seemed to be, seemed like everyone had an indie band.
I think it was, that was definitely the case, though. I think in the mid-90s, definitely off the back of the explosion of Britpop, bands were being signed left, right and centre, more so than probably, you know, any time since that, for sure.
Yeah, it just seemed like there were thousands of them.
Yeah.
And
so was you frequenting the Moles Club like regular?
Absolutely.
That was the toilet circuit venue at Bath, wasn't it? Where you'd see the breaking bands.
Yeah. Moles. Moles was, there was some sweaty nights in there. You know, the clubs around Bath, they were all the ones that they had that classic sort of beer-soaked carpet.
Yeah.
But also Bath being quite subterranean, you got used to the smell of what seemed to be fox urine.
Yeah.
You know, I can't walk past a fox these days without being reminded of 90s clubbing.
Of course. Okay, so, I mean, but going back a little bit before sort of Oasis was what, 94, 95, 96. Yeah. I imagine when, because you're 46?
42.
You're 42?
Yeah.
Ooh. Might want to check your Wikipedia.
Don't say it like that.
Might want to check your Wikipedia.
It's never a good sign when someone goes, you're 46, and you go, I'm 42, and you're like, you're 42?
So rude of me, sorry. Right, so now I'm seeing why I'm getting a little bit confused here then, because I'm thinking, well, if we're the same age, I am a few years older than you now, that I was presuming.
Yeah, you just sort of had infantile tastes in there quite a lot. You're going, what?
So you would have caught Britpop right as it was happening.
Yeah, it
right,
hit me. It was my lot that we were like into, you know, that was us. But what was also interesting was going into that Sega magazine, and because those people were slightly older than me, being exposed to their stuff as well. Or in the middle of, you know, the Britpop thing, you would have your Blurs and your Oasis and your Elasticas and all these Route One obvious choices. But you would also be exposed to, in the office, things like Blue Tones.
Yeah.
And their sort of lyrical beauty and a little bit of whimsy and you know, an emotion again. You know, proper emotion.
Mark Morris knows how to write a record.
He certainly does. So that was on a loop as well. Yeah. But I chose for this, just as the thing that sums up being that age at that time, something slightly iconic. And so I went for, Elastica Connection.
What a tune.
Just dun, 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 dun. And again, immediately you hear those opening notes and you're just like, I know where I am.
Yeah.
And it's 1995.
Yeah. And if you're not in an indie club, you're watching Trigger Happy TV, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So aside from Moles was more in Bath. I guess that was more the sort of live side of things. Was there indie clubs or did mainstream clubbing appeal to you as well? Would you kind of, because there'd always be like the sort of tan clubs that play the more commercial dance music. Did that ever appeal?
I tried.
Yeah.
I gave it a go.
Was it for you?
It didn't really speak to me in that way. I'd see my mates, if I was with like five mates, three of them would suddenly go insane. And I'd talk to the other one. Because I was like, this isn't quite me. I guess I like guitars.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just couldn't. I guess for some people, some things just don't quite connect in that way. And maybe if I'd been born 5 years either side, I'd have had those influences.
So, what did you want from a night out clubbing?
Well, it was never. I'm quite happy going out. At that stage, it was going out, beers, music, the idea that you might meet someone, not meeting someone, and then sitting on top of the public toilets eating a hamburger.
Yeah.
Those were my Friday nights and my Saturday nights with my pals. The drugs thing, I never got into. And because I think I'm quite naive to it as well, because I would go out with those guys from the magazines and it would not occur to me that they had suddenly taken something and were behaving in a more energetic fashion. My immediate thing was to blame myself and go, I need to up my game. I need to keep up.
Yeah.
And so that would give me sort of an energy boost in itself. And I would be able to, because I'd be like, disappeared for 5 minutes. He came back and he's like, he's full of beans, this guy.
Yeah.
And they were quite protective of me as well. And I was like a little brother. And so they didn't want to expose me to that either, which I appreciate.
Yeah.
So I never got into that side of things.
Ever sort of try?
No.
Because I didn't either.
Yeah.
And because I was too worried that it would, I'm a bit of a control freak to a degree.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And if I'm not in control of it, then I'd be a bit worried. But just looking at things like Yes Man and things like that, where and going back to what you said earlier of like, let's see what happens.
Yeah.
How comes that never sort of applied there?
Oh, well, maybe there's slightly. I mean, in my days in, you know, going to the clubs and stuff, there was never anything there. With Yes Man, you do open yourself up to another world.
Yeah.
But I was, you know, apart from, an incident in Amsterdam, there's never really been a moment where people come up to me and just kind of go, can I give you drugs and will you take them now? You know, because people will say that about Yes Man. They'll be like, oh, it must have been great with girls. And you're like, well, girls don't generally come up and go, hello, stranger.
Yeah.
Do you want to do this?
Yeah.
Because that would have been an easy yes.
Well, that's something I want to say then, because you're talking about being able to be quite a confident kid, and you said, and that's obviously carried on for your children now, where they can walk into a room and say, hello, how are you? When you was clubbing, would that apply to girls? Could you ever go up to a girl and go, hello, can I buy you a drink? Could you do that?
No.
No.
No. Absolutely not. Okay. Even now, I feel awkward. You're even shifting around on your hands.
Just thinking about you doing it. It's horrible.
No, not really. I think, you know, you have to gradually wear someone down over a period of months through conversation and hope that they initiate something.
Yeah.
That's the master plan.
Yeah.
Wear them down through conversation.
Yeah.
You know, but no, so I was never that guy, and none of my friends were either.
Yeah.
And we were never, I don't hang out with lads.
Yeah.
When I see or I hear stories about lads, I can't quite understand it. With the Me Too movement, like, I've sat down with my friends and gone, who are these guys? And how, like, how have we missed it? Are we them? Do we, what are we part of this? How yeah. do we do it? You know, I think there are just different ways of behaving that I haven't really, I suppose by choice, because you can choose your friends. And you just end up gravitating towards people like you. You end up gravitating towards the people who probably don't go up to women in clubs,
yeah.
And do that because they're, you know, well, A, they've probably gone off with the woman, so they're no longer there to have a pint with you.
Yeah. Yeah, totally agree. I was completely the same, mate. Okay, so I want to talk about radio a little bit as
yeah.
well. Because was X the first station that you worked on?
As a presenter, yes, I think it was. I'd done like docs and stuff like that, you know, documentaries about this and that, but I had never done a, right, sit down, this is just me, until then.
How did that come about?
I think they just asked me. They asked me to come in and have a chat, and then I had to record like a little taster, just 10 minutes, and I brought my mate in. I wanted someone to bounce off, and my mate is this, he's, now he's doing really well. At the time, he was spending his time between comedy and acting, and being a scaffolder, but he had the poshest voice you've ever heard, but also the gentlest voice, and he's a real gentle soul.
Not qualities you generally find in a scaffolder.
No. He'd have to sort of, you know, beef himself up a bit when talking yeah. to the lads on the spanners, as he yeah. calls it. But he had this really kind of gentle demeanour, and because I wanted the show to be different from all the other stuff, of not just men shouting at each other,
yeah.
but having a chat and getting to know the listener and being friendly. Mm. Because, as with writing, radio is the purest way, I think, to kind of make a friend you can't see, a friend you probably won't meet, but you have to make friends with them, just as you do if you're in a hotel in Spain with your parents and you have to walk into the games room.
Sure.
You have to disarm them a bit and talk to them like you've known them a while. And that's what I've always tried to do with my work. I think because it sort of comes naturally, whether it's an article or whether it's a book or whether it's a radio show, I want it to feel like we're already friends, which is why when people come up to me on the street and they'll say, oh, I read your thing, I ask them what it was, because then it feels like we've already had that conversation and I know what they know.
Yeah.
And we can just start from there rather than, you know, oh, nice to meet you. Hello, I'm Danny.
Yeah.
We're already pals.
Yeah.
And radio's like that every day or every week. And you do develop a real affinity with people you can't see because you're part of their life for those few hours a day.
And was there nerves sort of going into to something like that?
I guess the first time you do it, because it was a four-hour show.
You replaced Ricky, right?
I think it was, yeah. I think yeah. it was. It was a yeah Saturday, yeah. And that's difficult. That's happened a couple of times where I've stepped in after... You never want to be the guy after the guy.
Yeah, of course.
It's a kiss of death, usually, you know. You don't want to be the guy who takes over from Chris Evans after he's done the big breakfast.
Yeah.
You don't want to be whoever's going to take over from Graham Norton one day. You want to be the guy after that.
Yeah.
Or girl, or lady, or woman. Yeah. I don't know what I'm saying. You know what I mean?
When I say, what you
when
mean,
I say guy, I'm saying people. That's why I always use it that way. But, you know, so stepping in after Ricky, or as I did Adam and Joe when they were away from Six Music, or Russell Brand recently on X, they've already got a bunch of people who yeah. tune in for them.
That's a big shoes there, aren't there?
Yeah, and you have to come in and kind of go, I'll be your mate too.
Yeah.
And I'll do it in a way that's sympathetic to the things you like about the other person, but I'm going to do my own yeah. thing. And we can have this as well. But there was nerves doing it the first time. I guess that was 2007 or 8 on then XFM.
Yeah.
But it's really when you're looking at, you know, they call it a clock. You've got a clock to fill for each hour. And there's a number of times you know you're going to speak for 5, 6, 7 minutes. And you maybe know what you're going to say for the first two, but after that, how am I going to speak for 4 hours? But you do. You crack on because yeah. you become friends with the listener, and you draw on them, and you get their text and you get their ideas, and it gives you an idea for something else, and then you bring them in, and blah blah blah, and narratives form and stories are told and things are shared, and so it is like friendship, you know.
Excellent. Track 6, Danny. I don't know your answer for this one.
I know, so I struggled with this.
I'm going in blind. But I'm not surprised, because it's a favourite song from an artist from your home county.
Yeah, well,
or your hometown.
Where do I go?
Where are you going?
Yeah, well, I decided to keep it pure and go for Dundee, which is in Angus. Angus Tayside, but Angus. And so I was looking up, who's from Angus?
The View.
The View, Same Jeans. Yeah. That's a nice track. Mm-hmm. I think Alex Kapranos is from Glasgow, I think, so that's miles away.
I'm sure they're Glaswegian.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, you mentioned them earlier. Deacon Blue, I think, were formed in Glasgow, but Ricky Ross, I believe, was born in Dundee.
Okay.
So, but as we've established, as you, slagging them off earlier for not staying true to their Scottish roots.
I love Deacon Blue.
When you flipped the table and said the Proclaimers are the only true Scottish band.
Absolutely.
Oh, I bet you edit that out.
Yeah.
That's why you didn't hear it. He didn't do that. But Real Gone Kid.
Oh.
I remember being in a car park waiting for my dad to pick up some fish and chips or something, and that came on, and just sitting in the car and hearing that and thinking that's good. But I had no idea that he was born in Dundee.
Yeah.
So this really is a choice based on subsequent research rather than pure passion.
Yeah. Oh, they had some crackers, but I think on the same album, that Wages Day was another single off of that. Uh-huh. And that's a fantastic record. And I think they were back playing again last year. I'm sure they done
Taylor
Park last year.
Really? And that's a good place for them as well.
Yeah, of course.
Good place for them. Those sorts of, when the crowd, somewhere like Tea in the Park, gets behind a song.
Yeah.
They really get behind a song.
You need to... When you're going on YouTube to watch Marty McFly play with Coldplay, with Danny, also check out Proclaimers doing Sunshine on Leaf at Tea in the Park last year.
Don't worry.
That'll rip you in half, that one, mate. Did you ever get to see Deacon Blue?
No, I didn't.
No. Was gigging a big thing for you? Or is it still?
It could have been... And yet, comedy sort of took over my going out. There was a comedy club in Bath called The Fez, which was in a nightclub called Cadillacs, which again was sticky beer, maybe less fox urine.
Yeah.
But they started to bring in comics. And so when I was around 17, that's where I went. So mates were peeling off and going to gigs or going to Moles, and I would go to the comedy club, taking with me whoever I could, to see whoever was on. And it's where I saw people like, Tim Vine, Rich Hall, all these kind of people who more than 20 years ago were playing this little club, I would go and see. And so that sort of stopped me in a sense, because that took up that plugged that gap for me. Mm-hmm. For the live music, I'd still listen to loads of music and I'd still be properly into what I was properly into, but for some reason the comedy hit me where music hits others.
Yeah. And how quickly did you think, right, well, I want to have a bit of this?
I think immediately it sort of spoke to me, because I could kind of understand the rhythms and understand the I was fascinated by the techniques, in the same way that someone going to a gig and seeing a musician that they fall in love with for the first time, who have an affinity with that music. It's very similar with comedy. The rhythm of it, the pacing, closing on something big, that is what kind of really spoke to me, and which I don't know. It's not like you have to make a choice, but that was all-consuming.
It's really weird that you say about the rhythms and timings in comedy, because it's something that, like, personally, I just take it for granted, I imagine, as just someone in an armchair watching a bit of comedy or going to see it. But I spoke to someone and they were saying they're very good friends with Mickey Flanagan. And I went to the O2 to watch Mickey Flanagan do his stand-up. And he said, the thing that's quite strange there, for the, because obviously like, lots of comedians are now rock stars, aren't they? Multiple nights at the O2, you know, things like this. And they're saying that when you deliver the joke, because it's so big, the wave of laughter is different when it comes back to you. So you initially sort of get the laughter from the front part of the venue, but the back part sort of comes a little bit after, and so you don't get an instant roar. You get a kind of semi-muted average laugh. So it kind of messes with
you. It can mess with people. I mean, I remember seeing... I remember judging a comedy award or whatever, and there had been several acts who'd been fine. And it was a slightly strange setup for the room, so, you know, it's hard to see what they were kind of feeling. But then this other guy came on, Mark Haynes. He came on, and from his first joke, the atmosphere changed, and there was a physical... It felt like something from a film, you know, when there's an explosion that rips through, and things are flying and dust is going. That's how it felt. Just a woof that went through the room. And it was a woof of sort of confidence, and we're in safe hands, and this is going to be good. And, you know, there are those rhythms that we've mentioned. There are word choices. There's a lot that goes into, you know, I talked to Michael McIntyre about it once, about the moment of creation, or when you know that something is going to go somewhere. You just don't know where it is yet. It's like humming the first few bars of something that's going to be a song.
Yeah.
And you know there's something in it. And he said that's his thing as well. He thinks there's something in that. And so I said to him, tell me something right now that you think there's something in, that you haven't worked out what the something is. And he was just like, oh, it's a silly little thing, and it's not funny, but, you know, you get into the pool and it's freezing and everyone looks at you and they don't want to get in the pool because it's freezing, and then you have to say, it's fine once you get in. And that's something we all recognize, but it's how do you make that sort of bigger and better and funnier and even more relatable, and how do you bring characters to it and the other point of view and all this kind of stuff. And about 2 years later, I watched him on TV and he'd found the thing.
Yeah.
And it was now, you know, 4 minutes. And whatever you think of him, I happen to think that he's great.
Yeah.
The fact that he can speak through a TV screen and make an entire country or a lot of them laugh at home, stone cold sober, is pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely. Your final track, Danny?
Yeah, well, this brings me back, in a sense, to a lot of the things that we've been talking about. Music and comedy.
Okay.
And emotion.
Yeah.
And a story. And phrases and words and ideas well chosen. And it's Tim Minchin, White Wine in the Sun. And this is the song, you asked me to choose one that I think people should hear, right?
Yeah.
But they may not have, and perhaps lots have.
Yeah.
But if they can hear one, if they can hear a version of this, which is recorded live, that will make a big difference as well. It's a great song. It's a song just about family and distance and tradition and safety and reassurance. And it's really just a story of wanting to go home for Christmas, back to Australia, where obviously it's at that time of year sunny, and he knows that when he gets there, his mum and his dad and his sister, they're all going to be sitting outside waiting for him, drinking white wine in the sun. And the first time I heard it was at the Edinburgh Festival, and I was with my wife, and we knew Tim a bit at that stage quite well, but we hadn't heard this song. And my wife's Australian, and her dad was had just passed away, and so this was a very, very pure experience for her, knowing, you know, the kinds of things that Tim was talking about, and the family, and the sense of wanting to be somewhere and do that thing. And so on that level it speaks to me, but also it's just great. It's touching, and it's funny, but best experience live, and if not experienced live, heard as live.
Fantastic. What are you up to right now then, Danny? What's new? What's coming up?
It's coming up. I have to write a few scripts for a thing that may or may not happen. A lot of my job is for things that may or may not happen.
Yep.
But there's an American network interested in one of my ideas, and so I have to write them a few scripts before they go, actually, this was a giant mistake. and never hear from them again, which happens.
Yep.
So I've got to write that, and so that's a project which I enjoy because that's just me with a keyboard and some ideas. I do my show on Radio X, which I greatly enjoy because it's flexing a different muscle and having to be quite nimble. Yeah, and there's other stuff like that in between, books and all the rest of it, and being a dad.
Yeah. And sad to see the end of the shortlist.
That was a shame. That was a big, big shame, yeah. I've been writing for Shortlist magazine for over 11 years, I think. Yeah. 560 columns, maybe, something like that. And
it was a great column as well, man.
I enjoyed doing it. I really did. And I thought it would be very weird the first week I didn't have to do it.
Yeah.
But actually, it was quite nice not having to notice something every week.
Yeah.
Not having to go, there's something in that.
Yeah.
Just being able to notice it and go, oh, well.
Yeah.
But it was a great magazine, and it's a real shame. A lot of people were made redundant. Really good people who, in this day and age, it's difficult when they enter a market all at the same time.
Yeah.
Everything's kind of going online. Paper costs are up.
Yeah.
So it's difficult. But it was a great magazine with some brilliant teams who really sort of pushed the boundaries as well and were discussing things like male mental health before almost anyone else. So it did a good thing.
Danny, thank you ever so much,
thank
mate.
You.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
And we got away with it with no builders whatsoever.
Absolutely. Thanks, mate.
Cheers.
There you go, Off the Beaten Track podcast with the wonderful Danny Wallace. I don't need to tell you that he was wonderful because you've just listened to it. You're fully aware how wonderful he was. He was an absolute pleasure to sit with, and he was fascinating and interesting and kind and all the things that I hope this podcast is about, you know. Nice people talking about interesting things. That's the kind of the concept for what I wanted it to be, and I just hope you lot enjoyed it, and I guess I'll see you next time. Please, if you see us on the socials, like, love, share, retweet, and all of that malarkey. And if you can go over to iTunes and subscribe, that would be marvellous. If you want to find out about everything else Off the Beaten Track related, www.offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. See you next time. Bye-bye. Oh, yeah. Sorry. I've butted in yet again. I just want to quickly tell you about this magazine. It's called Pod Bible. Now, Pod Bible is the new essential guide to podcasts. It's put together alongside Spotify and Acast, and it's a one-stop shop to tell you all about the podcasts you maybe know about, but definitely about a load of the podcasts that you probably don't know about that we think you should know about. I mean, in the first edition, there's interviews with Adam Buxton, interviews with Craig Parkinson, there's features on Jade Adams, and there's just an abundance of information about so many exciting podcasts that are out there. Also, Spotify have given us these amazing little codes. So if you do get a print copy, you can just turn on your Spotify on your phone, scan the little code, and it just automatically opens up the podcast on your listening device. How good's that? If you haven't managed to get a print copy, then just go over to www.podbiblemag.com and read it online, because the digital version is all over there and it's all free. So every other month there'll be a new edition out. So go and have a look and support us on the social medias as well. Podbiblemag.com.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too.
Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.